All right, ready to dive into a fascinating Supreme Court case today?
Absolutely. Should be an interesting one.
It's Washington v. Davis, and this one's a big one for anyone in law, really.
Yeah, especially for anyone dealing with discrimination law. It really gets to the heart of how we think about discrimination, even decades later.
Definitely a case that's still debated all the time.
Yeah.
So what's so fascinating about this Washington v. Davis? What makes it stand out?
Well, you see, it really forces us to think differently about how discrimination actually works. Like, it makes us separate the impact of a law from the the purpose behind it. And sometimes those two things aren't always the same.
Okay, I'm intrigued. But before we go any further, could you set the scene for our listeners who might not be familiar with the specifics of the case? What exactly happened?
Sure. So picture this, right? It's the 1970s in Washington, D.C. Two black men, they're applying to become police officers.
Okay.
And they're suing the police department. They claim that the written test they use for hiring, it's called Test 21, is unfairly screening out black applicants.
Screening them out?
Yeah, like they're failing at a much higher rate compared to white applicants.
Ah, so this is where the concept of disparate impact comes in, right? Like, even if a rule doesn't explicitly target certain groups, the effects of that rule can still be discriminatory.
Exactly. You got it. And this case, oh man, it went back and forth through the courts. A real legal tug of war.
Sounds messy.
Oh, it was. First, the district court sided with the police. They said, look, the test is related to the job, right? And there's no proof the police department was trying to discriminate.
Okay, so case closed.
Nope, not so fast. Then the Court of Appeals comes in and totally flips the script. They said, hold on, this massive difference in who's passing the test, that's enough to prove there's a constitutional violation.
Whoa, a total reversal. So now it's up to the Supreme Court to untangle all of this.
You got it. Everyone's waiting with bated breath to see how SCOTUS is going to handle this whole impact versus intent dilemma.
The suspense is killing me.
Yeah.
So what happened? What did the Supreme Court decide?
Well, the Supreme Court, in a 7-2 decision no less, basically dropped a bombshell. They said that to win a discrimination claim under the Constitution, proving intent is absolutely essential, disparate impact on its own. That's not enough to win the case.
So wait, hold on. Let me get this straight. A law or policy can be having this huge unequal effect, but if you can't prove that it was designed that way from the very beginning, it's not unconstitutional. That seems, well, kind of tricky, to say the least.
It is tricky, and it's a big reason why this case still gets brought up all the time, especially in employment law. What the court did in Washington v. Davis was to draw a really clear line between claims under the Constitution versus claims under laws like Title VII, which deals with workplace discrimination.
Okay, I get that there are different laws, but why does that distinction matter so much? Help our listeners understand that.
Because Title VII, it actually does allow for claims based just on disparate impact. You don't have to go digging around for evidence of some evil intent. You know, if a company's hiring practices end up harming a protected group, that's often enough to file a lawsuit. Huh. But when it comes to the Constitution, SCOTUS was way stricter.
So with the Constitution, you're saying it's not enough to just show that the outcome is unequal. You actually need to prove that the people who wrote that law, they wanted that unequal outcome.
Right. Exactly. And that's where Justice White's majority opinion comes in. He was really focused on the idea that the Equal Protection Clause, it was all about preventing purposeful discrimination, you know, not just any negative side effects that a law might have.
That is a really interesting distinction. So how did the court apply that logic to this specific police test? What did they say about Test 21?
Well, they took a look at it and basically said, okay, this test is about literacy. And you could say that literacy is related to being a good police officer. And since there wasn't any super obvious proof, like a memo saying, let's make this test to keep black officers out, they ended up siding with the police department.
Wow. Okay. I'm starting to see how this case gets complicated, even controversial.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And there's a lot more to unpack here.
I bet. But we'll have to save that for the next part of our deep dive.
Sounds good to me. There's more to the story, though. It wasn't as clear-cut as it might seem.
Really? I thought the Supreme Court's decision was pretty decisive.
Well, remember, it was 7-2, not unanimous. And there were some pretty strong opinions from the dissenting justices. Like, Justice Brennan's dissent, that's definitely worth looking into.
Oh, what did Justice Brennan have to say?
He actually argued that, get this, Test 21, it didn't even meet the requirements for a valid test under Title VII.
Whoa, wait a minute. So even if you put aside the whole constitutional debate, he was basically saying that the test was flawed from the start.
Precisely. which adds a whole other layer of complexity to this case.
Yeah, it really does. So what did the majority say about that? Did they address Justice Brennan's point?
Well, they kind of sidestepped it, to be honest. You see, they were laser focused on establishing this broad principle about intent under the Constitution.
Okay, I see. It's like they were saying, look, even if this specific test has problems, that's not really the point here. We need to clarify what discrimination actually means, like at a fundamental level.
Exactly. And that makes sense, right? That's kind of their job, to clarify those big picture legal concepts.
It is.
Yeah.
But I can also see how that focus on the bigger picture might have missed some, you know, some real problems with the actual test itself. It's a tricky balance.
It is. And Justice Stevens, even though he agreed with the majority, he actually had a totally different reason for getting there.
Oh, interesting. A different path to the same conclusion. Tell me more.
Well, he emphasized that Test 21, you know, it wasn't biased on its face. Plus, it was being used all over the federal government.
Oh, widespread use. Like, that means it must be fair.
That was kind of his reasoning, yeah. It's fascinating, isn't it? How one case can expose these completely different ways of thinking about the law.
It is. But let's zoom out a bit, get away from the specifics of the case for a moment. How has Washington v. Davis actually changed how we approach discrimination cases? What's the big picture impact?
It's had a massive impact. Think of it like it set a much higher bar for plaintiffs. Before, you might have been able to argue, hey, this law is disproportionately hurting my group. That's discrimination. But after Washington v. Davis, you can't just say that anymore. You need to prove why that law exists in the first place. You need evidence that someone, somewhere, intended for that harm to happen.
I can see how that would be really challenging for people fighting against discrimination, especially when it comes to systemic bias. You know, it's not always a case of some evil mastermind saying, I'm going to discriminate now. It's usually much more subtle than that.
100%. And that's the big criticism, right? That Washington v. Davis, it might actually be shielding these discriminatory policies and practices simply because they don't have that smoking gun evidence of intent. It's like saying, well, we can't prove they meant to do bad stuff, so we have to assume everything's okay.
So even if a law is clearly hurting certain groups, as long as there's no written proof of bad intentions, it's basically untouchable.
I mean, it's not that simple, but you're definitely hitting on the core problem here. Proving intent, it's notoriously difficult, especially when you're dealing with these really deep societal biases that we might not even be aware of.
I imagine this puts lawyers and advocates in a really difficult position. If intent is the gold standard, where do you even begin to build a case?
Well, it forces them to be incredibly strategic. Like, do you try and make a claim under Title VII where disparate impact is enough? Or do you go for a constitutional challenge, knowing you need that much harder to get proof of intent? The legal strategy becomes as important as the facts of the case.
It makes me think about all the debates we see today, you know, where laws sound neutral on the surface, but the consequences aren't neutral at all. Like voter ID laws or zoning rules that end up pushing out certain communities. Does Washington v. Davis apply to those issues too?
Absolutely. It's incredibly relevant. Take voter ID laws, for example. Proponents say they're all about preventing voter fraud, right? But opponents argue they make it much harder for minorities to vote. And guess what the central question becomes? Can you prove those laws were intentionally designed to suppress votes, or is that just an unfortunate side effect?
Which, based on our discussion, sounds like an incredibly difficult thing to prove. Even if the impact is obvious, that doesn't automatically equal bad intentions. It feels like we're stuck in this loop where we can see inequality happening, but the legal tools to fix it are limited.
You've hit the nail on the head. It really highlights the limitations of legal precedent when it comes to addressing these deep-rooted societal issues. Washington v. Davis tried to establish a clear standard, but it also, maybe unintentionally, made it harder to separate discrimination from these complex real-world situations.
So even though they were aiming for clarity, they ended up raising even more questions. It's like saying, okay, intent is key. But what does intent even mean when we're talking about these complicated social problems?
Yeah, and that's where things get really interesting, right? Because it forces us to think beyond just the letter of the law and grapple with the spirit of it. Like, how do we make sure that equality is not just an abstract concept, but a reality, even when proving bad intentions is almost impossible?
We've covered a lot of ground today, but it feels like we've just scratched the surface.
We have. There's so much more to explore.
So what's next? Where do we go from here?
Let's get out of the hypothetical and into the real world. In part three, we'll dive into how Washington v. Davis has been applied in specific cases, from education to housing to criminal justice. That's where the true impact of this principle really comes to life.
Okay, so we're back for the final part of our deep dive into Washington v. Davis.
Time to get down to the nitty-gritty.
We've gone through all the arguments, the reasoning, the dissenting opinions, the whole nine yards, but let's talk about what really matters.
The real-world impact.
Exactly. How has this landmark case actually played out in different parts of the law?
You know, it's interesting, right? Because Washington v. Davis came from an employment discrimination case. But its central idea, that whole intent versus impact thing, it's had ripple effects way beyond the workplace.
Yeah, it's like this case set a precedent for discrimination cases as a whole.
Totally. Like, we're seeing it in education, housing, criminal justice, pretty much everywhere.
So it's not just about employment law. It's kind of become a framework for how we approach discrimination altogether. So let's start with education. We always hear about unequal funding between schools, right?
Right.
Like wealthier districts versus predominantly minority communities. Mm-hmm. How does Washington v. Davis come into play in those situations?
Well, imagine you're trying to fight that unequal funding, right? You're in court. You've got all this evidence showing the huge differences in resources and the impact that has on students, especially those from minority communities.
Right.
But proving that those funding disparities were created on purpose to disadvantage certain students, that's a whole other ballgame.
Yeah, it's not like there's a document somewhere saying, let's take resources away from these schools because of their racial makeup. It's more about how the system is set up, funding formulas, property taxes, all that stuff.
Precisely. And Washington v. Davis really raises the bar. Even if you can show beyond a shadow of a doubt that these funding differences are harming minority students, you still have to prove that the goal was to create that harm.
It's like you need to find someone saying, let's do this to hurt these kids, not just that the system is messed up.
You got it.
That's tough.
Yeah.
Seems like the same thing might be going on with housing discrimination.
Absolutely. Like with zoning laws, you know those laws that restrict the development of affordable housing in certain areas?
Right, right.
They might not explicitly mention race, but the effect is often that you get these wealthier, mostly white neighborhoods with better schools and stuff, and it becomes much harder for minorities to live there.
Yeah, it's like these laws end up concentrating poverty and limiting housing choices for people who aren't already well off.
Exactly. And trying to challenge those zoning laws using Washington v. Davis is incredibly tricky. Again, you'd have to prove that the whole point of the law was to exclude minorities, not just that it ended up having that effect.
So it's not enough to show that the outcome is bad. You have to show that it was designed to be bad.
Right.
It feels like Washington v. Davis is making it a lot harder to address those more subtle systemic forms of discrimination.
It definitely presents some challenges.
What about criminal justice? Has Washington v. Davis had an impact there too?
Oh, definitely. One of the big examples is when you're trying to challenge racial disparities in sentencing. Like, we know statistically that Black defendants often get harsher sentences for the same crimes as white defendants.
Yeah, that's a huge problem.
But proving that those harsher sentences are a direct result of bias from judges or juries, that's incredibly tough.
Yeah, how can you prove what someone's thinking? Even if you see a pattern, you can't get inside their heads and know for sure that they were intentionally discriminating.
Exactly. And again, Washington v. Davis sets that high bar of proving intent. Even if you have all the statistics in the world, you still need to prove that the judge or the jury in each specific case was intentionally discriminating.
So we're kind of in this bind where we can see all these inequalities all around us, but proving that they're the result of intentional discrimination is incredibly difficult.
Yeah, it's a real challenge.
It feels like Washington v. Davis, while aiming to create a clear legal standard, might have unintentionally made it harder to tackle those less obvious, but still really harmful forms of discrimination.
It's a valid concern for sure.
So after all this, what are the big takeaways here? What's the legacy of Washington v. Davis?
Well, first and foremost, it made it crystal clear that intent matters when it comes to discrimination under the Constitution.
Disparate impact alone isn't enough.
Right. Second, it really highlighted the difference between constitutional claims, where intent is king, and claims under laws like Title VII, which are more focused on the actual effects of a practice.
And maybe most importantly, Washington v. Davis really sparked a much-needed conversation about how to tackle systemic bias, even when you can't find that clear evidence of intent.
It's a conversation we're still having today.
Yeah, it's a really important conversation. And it makes me think, how do we build a system, a society, that recognizes and effectively deals with those less obvious forms of discrimination, even when proving bad intentions is almost impossible?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It is. It's a question that goes way beyond just this one case. It's about how we create a truly just and equitable world. And on that note, I think it's time to wrap up our deep dive into Washington v. Davis.
It's been a fascinating journey.
It has. Thanks for joining us, everyone. And until next time, keep learning, keep questioning, and keep fighting for a better future.